So this is Math 20B, and I'm William Stein. I'm the person who will be teaching this course. Feel free to address me by William. This is an outline for today. First, I'm going to give you an introduction slash overview to the course, by which I mean the technical details, where's the website for the course, how will you be evaluated, et cetera, et cetera. And then we'll talk about integration. This is going to be a review of what you saw probably at the end of the previous calculus course that you might have been in. So here's the overview. There's me. My email address is wstein@ucsd.edu, kind of standard. The website for the course is the following. http://modular.ucsd.edu/20b. There's also a general, so this is a coordinated course. All but one of the 20b lectures is coordinated. And this lecture is one of the coordinated ones. This is not the overall coordinated website. This is just the website I'm making specifically for this lecture. There's a link from here to the general coordinated website, which has additional information, some notes that are additional to the textbook that you'll want to download, et cetera, et cetera. But this is extra content that's relevant to this particular class. So can everybody read this? It says modular, like modular housing, or the modular group, .ucsd.edu/20b. So some examples of things that are here. Today, for example, I typed up notes for what I'm talking about, and you can download the PDF file of those notes. And when I remember, I'll record the audio of the lecture, and you can download that as well as an MP3 file. It would be really good if somebody would try to remind me to remember to record the audio if you don't see the recorder available. Questions so far? Let's see. My office is 5111 in AP and M. And this week, at least, I'll have office hours on Tuesday, that is tomorrow, from 11 to 1. This is tentative because I really don't have a clear sense of my schedule this quarter, and probably you don't either. So if there are a lot of people for which this is a horrible time, feel free to email me, and I'll set a different time. But tentatively, these will be my office hours. Because I'm new at UCSD, I'll give you a very, very quick bio of myself. So I went to grad school at UC Berkeley from 1995 to 2000. I got my PhD. And then I was at Harvard for the last 5 years as an assistant professor. And I just got hired here last quarter as a tenured associate professor. So I could be here for a while. And my main hobbies are anything involving computers, digital photography, and skateboarding. There's the skateboarding hobby, unfortunately, from yesterday. Now let me tell you about how the grading works in the course. I didn't decide on any of the grading in the course. This was decided sort of in a committee, but here's what was decided. There are, I guess, seven items that you may turn in. Four quizzes. These quizzes will occur on Fridays during the last 20 minutes of class, four times during the entire quarter. And the problems that are on the quizzes will be identical to problems that are in your homework. So all you have to do is do your homework and remember what you did, and you can get a perfect score in all quizzes. There will be two midterms, and these are during the fourth hour. So if you look at the course schedule, it lists this course as having Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 4 p.m., and it also lists a third time Wednesday, I think, at 7 p.m. And that Wednesday will be used only twice during the entire quarter, and that will be for the two midterms. So these are going to be Wednesday at 7 p.m., 7 to 7:50, they're not too long. And the days are on the 1st of February and the 1st of March. And finally, there'll be a final exam. Your grade will be determined using one of the following two methods. This gives your grade using one of two methods. One is 20% of your grade comes from quizzes. You get to drop one of the quizzes, by the way. Plus 20% from one of the midterms, so midterm one, 20% from midterm two, and 40% from the final. The other method that your grade can be determined is 20% from the quizzes, 20% from one of the midterms of your whichever was better, and 60% from the final. So this means that homework has no direct effect on your grade, it's just the quizzes, though the quizzes of course come as a subset of the homework, so they do have an effect. It also means that you can miss one quiz with no penalty at all, since one quiz is dropped. And moreover, you can miss one midterm, again with no penalty at all. It just means that your final will count for more. Also, if you do badly on one midterm, so badly that your grade will be better using the second method, then that's what will be done to compute your grade. Finally, if you get at least 90% of the total points in the course, you will definitely get an A. So it could be that even less than 90 will count as an A, but the minimum cutoff for 90 is A. I mean, the minimum cutoff for A is 90. Let's see. Okay, any questions so far? Yes, please. Sorry, I didn't see your hand.
I'm sorry I came in a bit late. Is everything you've covered up until this point on the course website?
Every single thing I said, almost verbatim, is on the notes that I've written for today, and these are on the website that's listed right there. Okay? So if you go to that website, you can download these notes. So don't worry. Yes?
Do you have a set date yet for the final?
Yes, I do. Date and time has already been determined. There's one subtle point about the final, though. So this is a coordinated course. There are a whole bunch of different 20B courses being taught, maybe four or five of them, I think five. And they all have the final exam at exactly the same time, because they'll have essentially the same final exam, and if the times are different, then you could just find out what was on it by finding out from somebody who had an earlier exam. So the implication of that is that if you look in the schedule, I think that there's a standard time for Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 4 o'clock courses to have a final. That's not the time for this course. The time for this course, as for all the other 20B courses, is 7 to 10 p.m. on Wednesday, March 22nd, okay? So everybody in any 20B has their final then. I don't know the exact location, but that's what it is. And if that doesn't work for you, then you need to determine that now and take appropriate action. Okay? Somebody else had a question, I think. Okay, so one other important thing is what can you take to exams? And quizzes, for example, are calculators allowed? So, again, I didn't decide this at all, but calculators are not allowed on any of the quizzes or exams. So, no calculators. That said, I personally am a huge fan of computers and calculators. I like them a lot ever since I was a kid. I was a little nerd playing around with the calculator. But so I strongly encourage the use of a calculator in your life and in doing the homework problems. But for the quizzes, no calculators. And for the exams also. One thing about this course is there's a whole bunch of integrals that you might imagine having to memorize. For example, what is the integral of sine of x? Okay, that one's not so hard, but there are some that are kind of hard to remember. And fortunately, you're allowed to have one piece of paper in which you can write as small as you want, on the front and the back, whatever you want. So on all the exams, except the quizzes, you don't put this, but you won't need it on the quizzes because they're just the same as the homework. But on the exams, you get one piece of paper. So one 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. And all the ways you can imagine putting something on that piece of paper are okay. For example, you can shrink it down with a photocopier and then use a magnifying glass to read it, et cetera, et cetera. There's no constraints. Unless you have some incredibly clever thing I'm not thinking of, but I doubt it. Okay, any questions at all? All right, so how about if everybody shouts their name? There's no possible way I can learn all your names because there are 100 people here. But if everybody shouts their name at once, at least I've heard your name. So on the count of three. One, two, three.
Chris.
Christina.
Wow, so I've heard all the names at once. The general name of you is But I'll attempt to learn more names. All right, so let's get started. So I'll start with some discussion about integration. And I'll begin with a little motivation. So suppose you have a function f that is continuous on an interval from a to b. So this is the graph of such a function. Everywhere in the rest of this lecture, f will be a continuous function on a closed interval from a to b. So I won't say that over and over again. But that's what f will always be in the rest of this lecture. So a really basic idea, calculus, to consider the area between the graph of the function and the x-axis. And it's important to be able to define the area, and the way to do that is to divide this interval up into n sub-intervals. Equal length. So each one has length delta x, which equals b minus a divided by n. And a way to sort of get an approximation for the area is to choose some point in each of the little tiny intervals. Let's call the point in the ith interval x of I. So zooming in here, you have, here's A, you have maybe a point x of 1 star and a point x of 2 star. You're just choosing one point in each interval. Doesn't matter at all what point you choose, just some point. Then I'm just trying to make some approximation for the area in kind of a negative manner. So in each interval, you choose one point, and I've labeled it x sub I, x sub 1, x sub 2, and so on. Now here's an approximation for the area. The area is approximately the sum, well, there's a formula for the area of a rectangle, and we can approximate this little piece of the area here by the value of f at the point x1 star times the width of the interval. So f of x1 star times delta x, the width of the interval when I divide it into n subdivisions. And then you can add to that the area of the next little rectangle, f of x2 star delta x, and so on, all the way up to the end, f of xn star delta x. And just for simplicity, I'll rewrite this using summation notation as sum I equals 1 to n f of xi star delta x. This is an approximation for the area. And then the definition of the area, which you may recall from a previous course, is the limit of these approximations as n goes to infinity. You get, for each choice of n, and then for each value of n and each choice of xi's in these intervals, you get an approximation to the area. And as you make n get larger and larger, you get a whole bunch of approximations that get better and better. And that sequence of approximations converges, it's a theorem, it converges to a limit, doesn't depend at all on the choices of the x of i's, and that limit is the area under this curve. And it agrees certainly with your intuitive notion of area, because if you just think about how we made it, it's a limit of things that approximate the area. Certainly, the sum of the areas of these rectangles should approximate the area under the curve. So the area is equal to the limit as n goes to infinity of the sum as I goes to 1 to n f of xi star delta x. Notice though that the choice of the xi stars and the number of delta x depends on n. Somebody's cell phone's vibrating. I'm worried it might be mine. It's not mine. So that's the area. And it's very closely related to the circle. So let me tell a little story that will give you a relationship between the velocity and the area between the curves. So this is a physical example to give some intuition for why you might care about areas under curves. So let's suppose you're reading Car and Driver or something in the airport, and there's this article about your favorite new sports car. And in the article, they're sitting there on the test track and they floor it, and they go really fast, and they measure the following. So the article contains a table that has the time and speed of the car in miles per hour at that time. So at time zero, the car is a complete stop. This is time in seconds. And at time one, we tell you the car goes all the way up to 5 miles per hour after 1 second. At time two, 15. Time three, 25. Time four, 40. Time 5, 50, and the all important 0 to 60, and in this particular car, 6 seconds. And they tell you that the car went an eighth of a mile. So, does that seem at all realistic? If you got the stoplight, you have an incredibly good sports car, well, maybe not incredibly good, but a reasonable car, and you floor it, these are the, you get to 60 miles per hour in 6 seconds, and these happen to be some of the other speeds as you go. Is it at all realistic that you could have gone an entire eighth of a mile in that time? So you wonder, and your gut instinct when you're reading this article in the airport is that it just doesn't feel right. So here's what you do to, so, I don't know, if you're like me, like reading things and then getting really mad at them and then trying to rip them apart. So I have it. So if you're like me, you might try to figure out how far the car would go, assuming, say, you know, giving the benefit of the doubt and assuming that it's going as fast as it could, just assume that it's going the maximum amount in each interval. So in other words, there's an upper bound on the distance that the car could have really gone. We're just going to use distance equals rate times time. Now, any questions? Okay, on the distance problem. So, the distance is the rate times the time. So I'll just consider what happens on each interval. So from 0 to 1 seconds, The car went somewhere between 0 and 5 miles per hour. It probably didn't go faster than 5 miles per hour any time during that interval, because it would be ridiculous for them to floor it and then slam on the brakes or something. So it just keeps going faster and faster. So let's just assume, giving the benefit of the doubt, that it went 5 miles per hour the entire time from 0 to 1 second. Definitely an upper bound. So it went 5 miles an hour, that's the rate, and this is for 1 second. So during the first second, it went 5 miles per hour for 1 second. Then, or actually went a little less, we're just giving it for about. Then during the next 3 seconds, from 1 second to 2 seconds, well, at 2 seconds it was going 15 miles per hour, so let's just assume that it went 15 the whole time to get an upper bound. So rate times time. And continuing, this is an upper bound on the distance it traveled, measured in seconds, miles per, well, this is an upper bound on the distance traveled. One thing is that the units here are seconds, and the speed is given in miles per hour. So you need to divide this by 3,600, which is the number of seconds in an hour, just to convert between seconds and hours. Maybe better at instrument hours. So let's just figure out what this is. So adding at the top, 5 plus 15, that's 20, 45, 85, 135, 195. Okay, so it's 195 over 3,600, that would be the number of miles. And I computed this beforehand, and that's about 0.054. Whereas 1/8 of a mile is 0.125. So the article is clearly wrong. This excellent upper bound on the distance traveled is way smaller than the amount of distance that the article claimed the car went. So you know something's wrong with the article and you shouldn't trust it at all. Now, the interesting thing here is that if you imagine the speedometer as a function, giving the velocity of the car at a given time, what you've written down here is very, very similar to what's written down here inside the sum. It's the velocity times the size of the interval. And if you could measure the velocity of the car very precisely at a lot more points than what we have here, then you'd get a better approximation for the distance that the car traveled, and you would be getting exactly the same formula as the formula for the area under a curve. So the fact of the matter is that the area, if you have a curve that describes the velocity of a car or any other object at time t, the area under that curve is the distance that the object travels from where it starts between those two points. And you're just seeing this very clearly in this special case. You just add up, it's the value of the function, the speed, times the size of the interval. The value of the function, the speed, times the size of the interval, and so on. And that's exactly the same formula that you have here. So, let's write that. So the area under f of t from a to b equals the distance of, let's call it v for velocity, is equal to distance object traveled from where it was at time A. So the reason I'm telling you this is just so that whenever you see integrals in the rest of the course, if you want, besides the area interpretation, a separate, more physical interpretation for integrals is as the amount of change in position of some object. So you can think about integrals in two ways. One is it's the area under a curve. The other is it's how much, it's where the car is after a certain amount of time if the function that you're integrating is velocity. Okay, now for the definition of integral. I haven't figured it out. So as usual, f is a continuous function on interval from a to b, and here's the quantity that we'll define. So this integral sign, it kind of looks like an S, and it really is meant to look like an S. It's supposed to be a sum. This is just supposed to be something that's a little more infinite than this finite sum you see here. You want to turn this somehow into an infinite sum. Well, you take a limit like we've done, and that's just the definition. So here's the definition. The integral from a to b of f of x dx is the limit as n goes to infinity of these approximations to the area under the curve. The sum as n goes from 1 to infinity of f x of I star delta x. Where again, though it's not in the notation, the choice of the x of I stars and the value of delta x, these both depend on n. So that's it. That's the definition of the definite integral. And an important fact, again, is that this is well-defined. It makes sense. Given any continuous function on a closed interval from a to b, this exists, this limit exists, it converges to something, some number. So you think about it, the integral is like an infinite sum, that's all. But where you've weighted as indicated. So this is the, it's really the sine area of the region between the graph of the function f of x and the x-axis. There's nothing really particularly special about the x-axis. You could also use the y-axis and then have an integral f of y dy, et cetera, et cetera. There'll be various tricks like that which will be extremely useful in solving problems, but this is what you need to understand right now. Suppose the sine area. By that I mean, if you have a function that looks maybe like this, then the area of this region, if you didn't take into account sine at all, would be this area plus that area. But see, this is below. So when you compute the value of f at points over here, so imagine a and b being right here and there. When you compute the value of f on the right-hand side that goes below the x-axis, f of xi, these are all negative. So you're getting negative numbers over here, and over here you have positive numbers, so there'll be some cancellation. So in general, the integral is the sine area. It's the sum of the areas above the x-axis minus the areas of the regions below the x-axis. Okay, is that incredibly crystal clear, or is it totally muddled? Excellent. That's what I want to hear. There are a bunch of properties that integrals have, like the integral of f plus g is the integral of f plus the integral of g, where you have functions f and g on some interval. Also, the integral of a constant times f is equal to a constant times the integral of f over that domain. But these are all very easy to see directly from the definition, and I won't write them down. All right, so now the fundamental theorem of calculus. So the problem with integrals initially and really finite areas of things, which turns out to, as you can see, be really, really useful to understand a lot of different problems. The problem is that you have this limit, and if you try to write this down explicitly, it's very, 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 very unpleasant. You'll end up having to do all kinds of contortions. And in fact, people did do that sort of thing thousands of years ago, or even 1,000 years ago, in order to find areas. For every single area that you ever wanted to find 1,000 years ago, you worked very, very, very hard on a sort of ad hoc basis for that particular problem and came up with some incredibly clever method to approximate this limit very precisely. But there's a much better way now, as of, I guess, 350 years ago or so, or 300 years ago, and that comes out of the fundamental theorem of calculus. So here it is. So it's really neat. It says that, so we have our function f, as always, continuous on the interval from a to b. It says that if you can find any function at all, capital F, differentiable function on this interval, and the derivative of this function, capital F, is equal to little f, you can find some magic auxiliary function like that, then the interval from a to b, this infinite, this limit of finite sums, so a sort of somehow infinite object that's tricky to compute, incredibly, it's equal to the difference of capital F at the two endpoints. So it's kind of amazing because it says that the area of the function F under that entire curve is completely determined by the value of, or the values of some auxiliary function at two points. It's kind of weird that this entire signed area is completely determined by the value of some other function here and here. But it's great because at least if you could find such a function, given an f, you might be able to find a capital F like this. If you can do that, then you can, for any interval at all, you can very, very quickly evaluate this thing over here, and evaluate the interval. And the fun thing is that you actually know a huge number of examples like this from 20a or wherever else you find some calculus from. For example, the derivative of x squared is 2x. That's an example where you have the capital F in the x squared, very simple example, and a little f, 2x, and they satisfy the relationship. Whenever you have two functions that satisfy this relationship, you can amazingly always compute the definite interval from one point to another of little f, just like that, just by taking the difference of two values of capital F. Now, a natural question arises when you see this theorem. Does capital F exist? If you write down some random continuous function, little f, that's really interesting to you, is there a capital F at all? Does that integral exist? I mean, does this function f exist? Is there some function whose derivative? Is there some function of the property that its derivative is little f? So what do you think? Raise your hand if you think there's always such a function.
He says if it's continuous, right?
Yes, I'm assuming f is a continuous function on a closed interval from a to b. So raise your hand if you think capital F always exists as a function. Raise your hand now if you think it doesn't exist, if there's some weird examples where there's no such function. Okay? Just to get you involved, that's all. So it turns out that capital F always exists. And I'm going to, except for a very slight but very reasonable possibility, I'm going to prove it for you right now. Okay? Capital F always exists. Now, this function, so given any little f, there is a capital F, its derivative is little f. This function capital F might not be very nice. It might not be a function you can write down just in terms of sines and cosines and exponentials and things you know. It might not be what's called an elementary function. For example, if little f is e to the 1 over x squared, there is a capital F in the interval that works, but that capital F is just some sort of complicated function that you can't write down in terms of sines and cosines and functions you might already know. Nonetheless, capital F always exists. Let me tell you what it is and prove that it works. Much of this course, by the way, will be about how to find, or at least understand, capital F, or lots and lots of different examples of little f's. Theorem. Capital F always exists. And here's what it is. Here's how you have to do. I'm going to pull up the sketch because there's one detail that we're talking about. This. You take capital F of x, just define it using an interval. It's the interval from a to x of f of t dt. There it is. That's a function. So you have a function little f, which maybe looks like this. And we have our interval from a to b. And I can define for you a function capital F. Remember, a function is something that takes a number, gives you back a number. It doesn't have to be given by some really simple formula. It just has to be something that gives, given a number, gives you back a number. And here's the number. So it takes its input, x, and then the output of the function is the area up to x. It's a function. You can imagine figuring out what the value of it is by some process, but it's a function. It's a well-defined function. The fact that it actually exists is equivalent to the fact that the integral is defined, that this limit exists, and that I'm not explaining to you.
Right.
It's believable because certainly the statement that the area exists intuitively makes sense. So now all I have to do is compute the derivative of this function and verify that it's equal to little f. So we need to convince ourselves that capital F works. Okay, any questions or comments? That's a little weird since you might not have seen a function defined via an integral before, especially given that you're supposed to be just learning about integrals today. But by the way, there are a lot of functions that are most naturally defined using integrals. For example, the log function. You may have seen it as the inverse of the exponential function, but there's another natural definition as the integral of another function from one point to another. Or there's something called the gamma function, which is very popular in engineering, and that's best defined using an integral as well. It interpolates, that is, it's a function that equals the factorial function at integers, the factorial minus one. Okay, so now let's convince ourselves that the derivative of f is equal to little f. And by convince ourselves, I mean, well, let's use the definition of derivative to compute the derivative of capital F. So remember the definition of derivative, f prime of x. The definition is it's the limit as h goes to 0 of this difference quotient, f of x plus h minus f of x over h. So let's figure out what this is simply by putting the definition of capital F as an integral into this formula, taking a limit, then using a little bit of intuition and figuring out what we get. Let's see if intuitively at least it looks like we should get little f of x as the result. So I'm really just following my nose. So this is a limit as h goes to 0. Now the definition of f of x, or of f at a point, is to integrate from a to that point of this function. So let's integral from a to x plus h, little f of t dt. Minus, and now let's substitute in what the definition of capital F at x is, that's just what's given here, the integral from a to x of t dt. Now, it would be very natural to get quite frustrated at this point. What can you do with these two things? However, let's just think about graphically what we're taking the difference of here. So again, I'll redraw the graph. I'll just put a simple piece of it here. So this is x. This is x plus h. And let's put a here. So what we're doing is we're taking the area under the curve all the way over to x plus h, and we're subtracting off the area over to x. So in the picture, what does it look like you're getting? Which area are you getting? If you take the whole thing and subtract off the first part. That's right. That's right. You're exactly right. It's the area from x to x plus h. So this, all it's equal to, is the limit as h goes to 0 of the integral from x to x plus h f of t dt over h. Is that right? So it's just the big area minus this thing on the left is this bit on the right. That's what this is. Okay, now if we make h small, and we're taking the limit as h goes to 0, then f, because it's a continuous function, it's basically almost constant on that interval. So let's just imagine that f is constant on the interval. This is where you need a little bit of intuition. You can make this precise by using the extreme value theorem and then trapping the value of this between a minimum and maximum value of f. But just for simplicity, let's just imagine that f is completely flat on this interval. So we're making h so small that in going from x to x plus h, and this is a really, really tiny interval, where for all intents and purposes, our function is basically flat. Basically the constant function, the width is that. It's basically the constant function for any point in there. For example, it's the constant function f of x on that little interval. So creating like a limit as h goes to 0, and for h very, very small, this top thing, it's the area here. What's the area if this were constant? What would the area be? It's the width times the height. So what's the width of this interval? H. What's the height of the interval if this function is constant? F of x. So the area is f of x times h. So that's what I put on the top, f of x times h. And on the bottom, I have h. So you end up getting, when you take the limit, the h is just canceled here, you get f of x. And you just prove the fundamental theorem of calculus, modulo the fact that there was a little bit of intuition over the theory here, which could be made precise using the extreme value theorem. And it's given completely precisely in Stewart's book, this one step. So here, we're using a little bit of intuition. So it's really can be easily made completely like this. Okay, so we started out with this function defined by an integral. We took the definition of derivative. We put our function into the definition of derivative. Did a little bit of sort of intuitive observation, and we ended up getting little f of x. So at least you should believe, intuitively at least, that the derivative of this function capital F is little f. So these functions are called antiderivatives. If you have a function little f, continuous on an interval, it has an antiderivative. That is a function whose derivative is little f. And a huge amount of this course is about finding nice formulas for antiderivatives. Given a little f of interest, for example, let's suppose you've always wondered, as I have since a young, young age, what in the heck is the area of this little hump if this is the cosine function? So this is the graph of cosine of x. And this goes from 0 to pi. What on earth is the area of this hump? I've always wondered. You can eyeball it. It looks like it might be, I don't know, this is pi, so maybe it looks like, I don't know, somewhere around 1 or 2 or 3. Who knows? And it's hard to tell exactly. You might think it's like half of the circle, so maybe it's pi over 2 or something. What is it exactly? Well, since the integral is just the area under the curve, if you can find a function whose derivative is cosine, you can use the fundamental theorem of calculus to find the area very easily. Does anybody know a function whose derivative is cosine? Negative sine. Excellent. Negative sine. So here's our little F. And we'll take our capital F to be minus sine. Maybe think of another function whose derivative is.
Isn't that the sine function?
Yeah. Isn't that the sine function?
Wait, what's wrong?
The sine is not a function, it's 0, 0.
Okay. Oh, I got the sine. I've always wondered what the area is in the sine. Okay, so what's a function whose derivative is sine? Minus cosine. Okay, can anybody give me another function whose derivative is sine?
1 minus cosine.
Excellent. Yeah, any constant to it at all, it doesn't make any difference. So now let's use the fundamental theorem. The integral from 0 to pi of sine of x dx. This is equal to, well, it's capital F at the right-hand point, minus cosine of pi, minus cosine of 0. So cosine of pi, that's minus 1. This is minus 1, minus 1 again. That's 2. So amazingly enough, this area is 2. So now I know finally after all these years that the area of a hump under sine, which is really the same as under cosine, just one that translated the other, is 2. Okay, so I'm going to stop there. There's still 3 minutes left, but I won't use them. And I'll see you on Wednesday at 4 o'clock. Oh, by the way, section will meet on Tuesday. So do go to your section tomorrow.
Okay.
There's a section. Section will meet on tomorrow, as scheduled. Don't worry too much.